All right, welcome back. I'm glad we didn't scare you off. I see some of you brought some of the books. I wanted to start by asking if you've had a chance to start reading anything and what you think about it. And any volunteers? Hertzberg.
No.
Oh, Herzl. Oh, Alte Neue Land. Old New Land. Yeah, it's a great book.
Got halfway through, I couldn't read it.
It.
I mean, because he's hopeful.
That's so interesting.
My children, the wonderful hope that he had.
Right. Keep in mind, if you decide to go back to it, okay, why he was writing it and when he was writing it. It was basically a book of propaganda, and it was meant to really instill, you know, in the masses, the concept of this can happen, this is the dream, you're going to make the dream a reality. And he sets it in the future. It's not going to happen right now, but it's in the not-so-distant future. And, you know, I enjoyed that book because I thought it was so fantastic that someone could actually think this way. And, you know, the Arab guy, what was his name, Bashai or something like that, he was so happy that, you know, that the Jews had come there and everybody spoke their own languages and the fundamentalist candidate was pushed out of the elections, basically. He tries to answer every question that his opponents have. And we're going to get to it and we're going to talk more about it. But I'm glad you started that book. You were going to say something? Book. That's a tough book. We talked about it.
Can you pronounce that guy's name?
I read the first chapter.
So you have to know about Hobsbawm. First of all, you have to know that my friend and colleague David Starr picked that book. And I told him it was a difficult book. But it does set, you remember you were there in the conversation, it does set fundamentals of what's going on. The problem with that book is it's so dense that it's hard to remember from one page to the next what's going on. What you'll find is the last chapter is the most interesting one because it talks about the modern states and the breakup of the Soviet Union. I did some research on him. You also have to know that he was a communist theorist also.
Jewish.
Oh, I didn't know he was Jewish. That didn't come up in anything.
Yeah.
How'd you find that out?
I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay.
Wikipedia. Yeah,
okay. I didn't look at a Wikipedia entry. The Wikipedia rules the world. It's considered a classic. Next week we're going to deal with nationalism. We're going to deal somewhat with that book. It lays a theoretical framework. The most important thing that you're going to get out of that book is the concept that nationalism started in the late 18th century and what goes into nationalism, language, coinage, boundaries, and how they deal with various ethnic groups within their borders. And he goes into the very detailed examples of what and why that comes to be. So, but yes, it's difficult.
Just
Mitchell?
As a suggestion, on that book, what I found it impossible to read. I went into the
I told him.
Index, and I just picked out either Israel.
There's a lot in there on Israel,
and
actually.
And I just went to the Zionism, I think.
Zionism.
Zionism. And I just went to specifically where, you know, where he talks about Zionism and just read the...
Terrific. But yes, it's a difficult book, and I understand. And because of that, one of the things I've done for next week, we'll find out, is I've expanded it to not just the concept of nationalism, but what we call other Zions. There have been many attempts throughout history, Jewish history, which is history, to create a Jewish homeland in places other than Israel, Palestine, the land of Israel, whatever you want to call it. Whether it be the Soviet Union or even the Nazis had a plan, believe it or not, at one point. And anyone else who have been doing any reading had an opportunity? Anyone at all? What'd you think? What stood out for you? Okay.
The
early settlers in particular.
Right. Very interesting.
That's terrific. And one of the things that you should know too, and I don't know if I directly mentioned it in these words last week, is that when we talk about the history of Zionism, we're really talking about a history of battling ideologies and towering figures. You know, it's been said that every great Zionist leader from the early years was patently crazy. And we're going to meet these people. They're bucking the tide of history. They're creating something new that was never there before. Zionism was a remarkable ideological revolution. I did remember saying last week that Zionism has been called the most successful nationalism of the 20th century, the most successful national liberation movement, if you want to use that terminology. Sometimes when, you know, we think of a nice Hamish, a Jewish state, we don't want to use that terminology. It puts it in the classification of some African states and revolutions and overthrowing stuff. Well, that was part and pat and parcel what was going on here as well. Everything that happened in Israel was the same as what happened elsewhere in some regards, with the difference that almost everybody who was involved was an immigrant. It wasn't necessarily a native population. The leaders were almost all, not all, but almost all immigrants. Okay, yeah.
So which book, Hobsbawm?
Oh, really? Okay.
But I thought it was great, but it,
right.
It just hasn't been, you know, when you compare where we are.
It was a society on the edge at all times, and everybody who came to be a part of that society was an ideologue, particularly in the early years. They later became, a majority of them became refugees after 1948, the people who moved to the land of Israel, the state of Israel at that point. But you're right, I mean, we're going to find out in 1882, 16 people go from the Ukraine to Palestine, the Bilu it's called, I think it was mentioned in the book, and then by statehood in 48 you have 650,000 people, and then 2 or 3 years later you have 2.5 million people. It's remarkably short. And Herzl, by the way, people laughed at him. He said there'll be a Jewish state in 50 years. Almost exactly 50 years when he said that, in 1897 to 1948. Amazing. Yeah?
Why was it?
Well, it was the UN. It was in 1975 when they passed that resolution, and then it was in 1991 when it was overturned. The Zionism race. It was a third world Arab state-driven thing because Zionism was always seen by the Arab world as colonialism. And the third world hates colonialism. So they saw that as a racist policy of the European white man trying to get a foothold in the Middle East. That's why. Exactly. Yeah. Give me a little detail. I'm not quite sure what you're talking about. You mean Jews who weren't Zionists? Right.
Well,
and the truth was, until pogroms in Russia in 1881, things were never necessarily good, but they were tolerable. They became much worse at that point, and then they got much worse in 1903 with the Kishinev pogrom and some other things. But and Jews were also always involved in other movements as you move on into the Enlightenment era, right? They were communists and socialists, and we're going to get to this 1 week, territorialists and all those other ists. Marxist communists. So, yeah, but the Jews were primarily Mensheviks, not Bolsheviks. So you get into the communist ideology then. Marx, Lenin, and Trotsky, and so on, or Lev Bronstein, as we'd like to call him. You know, by the way, Trotsky's great-grandson lives on a kibbutz on the West Bank. I read an article about him a few years ago. That's one of the great ironies of history. You know, here's a guy who was the founder of the Soviet Union and gave it all up for the Jewish state, for the homeland. All right, well, that's terrific. Now, great job sharing. Now tell me, help us review, what did we cover last week? Help us set the stage for this week. Anybody remember anything we talked about last week? Of course you do. Of course you do. Spill out something. We talked about the Messiah. Remember the idea of the Messiah and how that has been an idea that's been permanent throughout Jewish history. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that tonight as well. And we talked about other religions and how they viewed the Messiah. Right, Christianity. And Christianity, how they have a concept of the heavenly Jerusalem and the earthly Jerusalem as well, and how the concept of Zion is important to them as well. Mitch?
That would just say how many ways Jews, mostly prayer and the Bible and the Tanakh, just everything works back to
right.
If you're Jewish. No other religion has.
Well, and it's very interesting you say that, because you say that you're basically, if I'm correct, you're saying that Judaism is a land-centric religion. But, of course, Reform Judaism will come on in the Enlightenment period and flip that on its head. What they're going to say is we no longer focus on the land. We have to spread Jewish values all over the place. We don't believe that there's going to be a Messiah. We believe that Messianic era is when humans are all good to one another, and so on and so on. So there are different themes, strains running throughout Jewish ideology on that as well. But today, you're correct in that Judaism has become land-centric again, and the Reform movement is a leader in that, as much as anyone else, I should say. But any of the prayers, one of the things we did last week, if you recall, is we took a look at some of the prayers, and we looked at how common this concept of Zion and Jerusalem and Zion was. Remember, Ki Mitzion Tetzé Torah, from the land of Zion goes forth the Torah, or the teaching. The Haggadah was codified in the Middle Ages, as were most of the prayers were conceptualized in the Middle Ages. But there are pieces of it in the Talmud in terms of, and that's what they take. They build from like stories in the Talmud. I don't know when that exact line. I don't know when that exact line came into being, so I don't want to mislead you.
That is another example of our night with Israel. With
absolutely. Israel. Next year in Jerusalem, Hashana Haba'aba Yerushalayim, and there becomes a debate in modern times: is what does that really mean? Does that mean I'm supposed to visit Israel? Does it mean I'm supposed to live in Israel? Or does it mean I'm just supposed to dream about Israel? And that gets into the natural tension between diaspora and the state of Israel, which, if we fast forward to next year, that will be a major theme, what we do then.
As you said, we have every we visit.
Yes, yes. I'm very good friends with him. He always says that to me. Welcome home.
The other one I like is Haaretz.
The newspaper.
Israelis refer to
Israel, the land, okay.
The land.
Right.
Not land in Africa.
Right.
Biblical.
If you, in modern Hebrew, you say, I'm going back to Israel, you say, I'm going back to the land, and Chozer La'aretz, to the land of Israel. So Haaretz is also the name of a newspaper,
right.
That's what I thought.
Right.
Did you want to say something?
No.
Okay. All right. What else did we talk about? We did talk about Zion and Jerusalem and all that. We looked at text, and we also looked at the idea of return. We looked at the seeds of where all this is coming from. And this is going to become very important for us, because what we're going to see tonight is that the Jewish religion goes from one of being a national religion to just a religion. It doesn't go back to becoming nationalist until the modern era and the Zionist movement. So we're going to be talking really about 1700 or so, 1650 years or so, when Judaism really simply becomes a religion. And it has an echo of the land centrality in it, but it's not as focused on it as it was in the past. But we also spoke, of course, about the Babylonian rule, and we talked about what was really the first new state. Was it Medinata Yehud or Yehud Medinata? I can't quite remember. When Cyrus the Great signed the return decree, the decree of Cyrus the Great, and they were able to go back and they were able to start rebuilding the second, what would become the Second Temple. So, good. Any questions? We talked a little bit about reading, and we've talked a little bit about what we did last week. Any questions on anything to date? All right, looks pretty good. Tonight, we're going to start with Alexander the Great, the Hellenistic era. We're going to spend some time talking about that era, and we're going to spend some time talking about the Maccabees and Hanukkah and the Roman era and Masada and what the rabbis did. And then we're going to delve into the Middle Ages, and hopefully if we have time at the end, we're going to wind up with talking just a little bit about a group called the Khazars, which was a group, a Jewish kingdom in Central Asia, in the Soviet lands, which research is beginning to explore more now that the Soviet Union has fallen apart. Alexander the Great was a fascinating figure, right? He was in his teens when he took over from his father, and he was dead by the age of 32. At the age of 32, however, he was the unquestionable ruler of the world, and that, of course, included this very small land called Israel. What we're going to see tonight, too, by the way, and what we're about to see, is that it's often been said, you've probably heard it said before, that the land of Israel is at the crossroads of the world. It's where armies came back and forth across there, and they were always fighting over it. For whatever reason, and we hold our own personal historical or theological reasons in our heads and hearts, this small land has been significant beyond proportion on the world stage throughout history. It was certainly the case in the Greek times and the Roman times that followed it. Alexander the Great was said to tolerate the Jews because his great teacher, you know who his teacher was, anybody? A guy named Aristotle. Yeah. His great teacher, Aristotle, had implanted in him the idea that there is a God. Now, he had a different perception of God. He believed that God basically pushed the lever that set the universe in motion, and that was it. But and doesn't care about human interaction. But as I said, Alexander took over from his dad, Philip. First, he conquered Persia, and then he went after all the other lands. And keep in mind that in ancient times, armies weren't necessarily what we think of today. You know, today, at least, and I get political for a moment, the United States has a military mission. That mission will go on for as long as the public is willing to support it. And at one point, if the public doesn't support it anymore, the president is going to be forced to start withdrawing troops. Well, the Greeks and the Romans, if they decided to siege your city, they would surround your city, for a couple years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, whatever it would take. That would be their mission. You talk about time not moving quickly. You know, Baltimore, well, time didn't move quickly at all in that regard. They would just have their mission, and they would go for it. So in 329, his campaign finally brought him to the land of Israel. Let me write that up here. In 329, campaign brought him to the land of Israel, and he was taking over from the Babylonians, who were not the force that they once were. He basically marched through unopposed. And it's a very interesting scene. Simon the Just was one of the last men of the Great Assembly. Anybody ever heard of the Great Assembly? If you look at Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, one of the first Mishnah says the law basically was given to Moses and to Joshua and to the men of the Great Assembly. Right? So it's seen as, and this is one of the great, maybe or maybe not, inventions of the rabbis to give themselves validity because they considered themselves to be descendants of the Great Assembly. So Simon the Just was the last of the Great Assembly. He was a high priest, and he ruled the land of Israel, which basically meant that he was ensconced in Jerusalem, and he oversaw the temple. Actually, no, the temple had been destroyed by then, but he ruled the land of Jerusalem from there. The Talmud tells us, Simon the Just came forward with other priests and sages to greet Alexander at the gate of Jerusalem. Alexander rode up on his white horse. He had his terrifically impressive army behind him. This was not somebody that you were going to mess up with. This was someone that you were going to take very, very seriously because, of course, he could have you killed and you still don't necessarily know what your fate is going to be. So Alexander sees Simon the Just. He gets off his horse, which is highly unusual because he doesn't get off his horse for just anybody, and he bows down. His men are all wondering what's going on. His advisors have come up to him and question him, and he says whenever he went into battle, he dreamed that an angel would lead him into battle, and the angel had the face of Simon the Just. Again, this is another great example of where the Jews really, really lucked out. Now, I can't tell you this is true, but I also can't tell you it's untrue. And it's as possible as anything else. Let me read you exactly what they say in the Talmud, because it's really interesting. When the Samaritans had obtained permission from Alexander to destroy the temple in Jerusalem, the Samaritans and the Jews always fought. The Samaritans used to be a very significant force, really through much of the Middle Ages in Israel. There's a mountain, Mount Gerizim, where they live around the villages there. There still are some Samaritans in Israel. There were various times in Babylonia as well when the Samaritans rivaled the Jews in terms of popularity, and the rabbis were always fighting the Samaritans, who were a little more lenient than the Jews were.
It was
ostensibly an offshoot of Judaism, and they would have some people going back and forth between the two communities. It, in some regards, this is a very bad analogy, it would be like the Orthodox trying to fight the Reform, right?
Or Shia.
Shia Sunni, that's a better analogy, thank you. Right, right. And you can go and visit them, and they do Pesach a little differently, and, you know, it's a nice tourist thing.
They predicted,
do tell.
Who eventually made all the
marriage. Do tell, they predicted the birth of your third son?
Yeah, well, first time.
9 months later.
Shades of Sarah in the Bible, right? Shades of Sarah in the Bible, laughing. That's terrific.
And he's the one who made all of
it. I've never met somebody who's had the Samaritans make an impact on their life. So, and he's the one that made Aliyah. Is he a Samaritan today?
No.
No? Does he know the story?
Yes, he does.
That's terrific. All right. So keep in mind, this is one of the ancient fights within the Jewish community about the Jewish community. When the Samaritans had obtained permission from Alexander to destroy the temple in Jerusalem, the high priest Simon the Just, the temple still was there, I'm sorry, arrayed in his pontifical garments and followed by a number of distinguished Jews, went out to meet the conqueror and joined him at Antipatris on the northern front. At the sight of Simon, Alexander fell prostrate at his feet and explained to his astonished companions that the image of the Jewish high priest was always with him in battle, fighting for him and leading him to victory. Simon took the opportunity to justify the attitude of his countrymen, declaring that far from being rebels, they offered prayers in the temple for the welfare of the king and his dominions. So impressed was Alexander that he delivered up all the Samaritans in his train into the hands of the Jews, this is great, who tied them to the tails of horses and dragged them to the mountain of Gerizim. Then the Jews plowed the mountain, demolishing the Samaritan temple. Well, there's a very interesting debate that comes up from this too that we're going to see repeatedly, and we're going to see it with the Bar Kokhba rebellion, and we're going to the siege in 70. We're going to see it with the rebellion in 135. We're going to see it in Masada in 73, which is, do you surrender or do you fight to the last ounce? And sometimes it's not so clear, and we're going to see that tonight. Alexander made the deal with the Jews that the Romans would later make with other people, but it was very unusual for Alexander. He basically said, pay me your taxes, behave well, and I'll leave you alone. Well, the Jews were thrilled at this because, like I said, it really didn't happen. He said, be loyal vassals and you'll remain autonomous. Anybody ever hear of anyone with the name Sender? I have a little kid who lives next to me. His name is Sender. His parents are ultra-Orthodox or Haredi Orthodox. Sender, it comes from the name Alexander. It's not an uncommon name in the Orthodox community. Jews from then until today were so pleased that Alexander gave them the right to continue to worship and live as they wanted to, that they literally named their kids after him, which is interesting. And I assume that now they're naming it after other people, but it's interesting because that the tradition of naming your kid after somebody who is deceased apparently did not exist back then. Jews took on Greek names, and we know that they're going to take on Greek culture, right? Because we know about Hanukkah and the Hellenists. They began speaking Greek, all setting the background for the Hanukkah story. Any questions until now? No? Okay. Well, like I said, Alexander is going to pass from the scene pretty quickly. That's in 323. He's only 32 years old. He probably died of some type of an infection. He didn't die in battle. It was one of the great mysteries. More so for our purposes, that what we're interested in is that his empire didn't stay together. It split up. His empire split into the, so I can spell this correctly, Seleucids and the Ptolemites. Seleucids were basically in Syria or the northern part of the kingdom, and the Ptolemites ruled from Egypt. The Ptolemites, we get Mark Antony and Cleopatra, by the way. Many of us obviously know that story. But suddenly, the man who controlled the world was gone. All bets were off the table. Nobody knew what was going to happen next. These two would fight for 100 or so years for territory. Guess what was smack in the middle of their territories? The land of Israel was smack in the middle. In fact, 7 different times over the next 100 or so years, the land would switch and the Jews would be paying taxes to a different government. They literally never knew who to be loyal to next. It was a very precarious and dangerous time in many regards, and things weren't getting any better. The South used Greek culture to lure the Jews in. They basically would build them gymnasiums, throw festivals for them, or what have you. The North attempted force, and we're going to see that later on in the Hanukkah story. Right? It's going to come from the Assyrian or the Syrian North is where that's going to come from. Finally, in the year 198, I was bored with the knockbacks, and someone's going to walk in here and have no idea what any of it means. Yes, this is BCE, before the Common Era. That's correct. Thank you for clearing that up. You know, it's funny, when you deal with Jewish history, it's such a long stretch of land, you really have to make that very, very clear. Antiochus III of the Seleucids finally wins in 198. Anybody know the name Antiochus? Anybody? Heard of that before?
Yeah.
Yeah? Well, from what? Hanukkah. It's going to be his son. Right? This is Antiochus. And let me spell his name out. Antiochus. Antiochus. This is Antiochus III. He eventually embarks, when he gets everything under control, on a Hellenization plan for the territories that he's conquered. He backs down. It's a little too hard. The Jews are a little rebellious of this. His son, however, is going to come to power in 178. Son, not going to be such a nice guy, and he's not going to be remembered so kindly by the Jews. His son has the same name, Antiochus IV.
178 BCE.
This is the one that we know from the Hanukkah story. He outlaws Shabbat and the owning of Torah, and he puts a temple of Zeus in the temple. Now, when I was in undergraduate school, I took a course in Roman history, and the professor, Dr. Eckstein, I remember, once said when he was talking about Roman history, is that, you know, the advisors once said to the Caesar, you can do anything you want to the Jews, but don't mess with their temple. They're crazy about that. And that's exactly right throughout history because, as Mitch was saying, Judaism was a very, or Israelitism, to be technical, was a very land-centered religion at this point. It was a national religion, and it was centered on Jerusalem, and it was centered on the Temple Mount, and it was centered on the Holy of Holies within the Temple Mount itself. So it was a bad idea. So rebellion began to simmer. This is 198. By 167, there's a priest called Matthias, I'm just going to write it up here in Hebrew.
Transliteration. Matiyahu. Matthias, I think, is correct in English, right?
Yeah.
Anybody? Okay. Matiyahu or Matthias. Anybody know the story of what he did? Anybody know the story of what Matthias did? All right, Matthias was a priest. He was at the village of Modi'in, which is between today's Tel Aviv, which, as we're going to learn, wasn't founded until 1909. We're going to talk about the remarkable revolution just as a side. The fact that Tel Aviv was founded in 1909, about a century ago, and has 1.5 million people living in it, that's remarkable. That's the only time a city of that size has grown with that speed in world history, based on my knowledge. I certainly could be wrong, but certainly in the modern era, that's the case.
A very cool city to boot.
You have to be a hipster to love Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
or the beach. Did you ever see Don't Mess with the Zohan?
Yes.
The beach scene in the beginning is classic Tel Aviv. Hey, maybe I'll show that clip when we... maybe not. Anyway, he sees a fellow Jew making a sacrifice to a Greek god. And there are Greek soldiers standing around as well. Greek meaning Assyrians, the Seleucids. And he is so enraged that he picks up a sword and he runs over and he stabs the guy in the gut. Right? None of these stories are without violence. He stabs the guy in the gut. The guy dies. Thus is born the Hanukkah Rebellion. And it's unusual if you think about it. The priests are supposed to be, I always loved it, supposed to be religious, sacred people. You figure they're attending to sacrifices or dealing with temple matters or, you know, giving pastoral counseling to their fellow villagers or what have you. Well, this guy picked up a sword and stuck somebody really, really good.
A fellow Jew.
And that's one of the issues we're going to talk about tonight in a few moments. The story of Hanukkah, as beautiful as we like to say it is today, was really a bloody civil war, and a very bloody one at that. Matthias had 5 sons. One of them, of course, was named Judah. They were Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, which later became known as the Maccabees. Anybody know the word Maccabee in Hebrew, what it means? Maccabee, other than the beer? Great beer, but it's not so great. It's okay. Hammer, correct. It means hammer. And in fact, if you go to Israel, various holidays today, they have these little hammers, including Hanukkah, where they bop you on the head with them, and they're plastic, and they make this really weird sound. It's particularly popular in Purim. Patish is what they call it, actually. Their revolt was aimed as much at Hellenizing Jews as it was at Greeks, and they weren't afraid to be very bloody. They went around destroying altars, village by village, because every village had an altar to a Greek god in it, and they circumcised boys that hadn't been circumcised. I'll show you the extent that they went to. Finally, in 164, captured Jerusalem, which was, of course, the prize of prizes. They repurified the temple. It took more than 2 decades, finally, but by 142, the Seleucids were out. The story of Hanukkah didn't end with the rededication, or the repurification of the temple. The Assyrian Greeks were still around, particularly in the northern Galilee, for years to come. Independence would be restored, and this was the first time in 500 years. It would only last 80 years. So what's the legend, by the way, that we know about the Hanukkah story? The lights? Whoops. So give me a little more. Well, enough oil, right. They went. They needed to light the menorah, the candelabrum, and they didn't have enough oil, but somehow it lasted for 8 days. Does anybody believe that? Well, why not? I mean, it's entirely possible. I'm not saying no. I'm just asking you guys. If you refer to it as the Hanukkah miracle, then you believe it. Absolutely. And our we sing about it in our prayers and all this, and, you know, it's one of the classic miracles of Jewish history. Yeah?
I wonder if all the sort of positive attributes of it are fairy tale that...
You are so on target. We're going to talk a little bit more about it, but you're so on target. And I'll tell you as an aside now that there was a time when I was younger when I was so troubled that I really didn't want to celebrate Hanukkah. Really didn't want to celebrate Hanukkah because I thought it was really just about Jews killing Jews. And, you know, I was worried about, current implications of what that meant. You know, did it mean that, I was celebrating fundamentalism, which is not something that I'm in favor of. And I basically over years just softened and started buying my kids gifts, you know, because it's so much a part of the culture. But one of the things that we're doing in this course is we're taking a look at the popular Jewish culture and we're seeing how it stands up to the historical record and what it means. And you've hit on what I consider to be a very serious dilemma that needs more thrashing out. And we're going to do some of that tonight, I promise you. And pretty soon. All right. Tell me your first name again. What?
Mark.
As Mark is insinuating, you know, we have this story of the great heroes of Jewish history. I mean, if you ask any kid in Hebrew school and even Jewish day school what they think about the Maccabees, they're going to say they're great freedom fighters. They really are. But they're not. It's not necessarily the case. Judah Maccabee is legendary, right? Judah Maccabee was killed relatively early on in the battles, by the way. He was stomped to death by an elephant. So he didn't have that much time on the battlefield. This was about militaristic pride. There's another story involved, which is equally disturbing. Anybody ever heard the story of Yehudit or Judith? Okay, so Yehudit or Judith, I'll write her up here. Judith was a pious, as we're told, Israelite, Jewish woman. And she had been widowed for a number of years. And she basically said to the leaders of the Jews, the leaders of the revolt, I'm going to go kill the Greek general.
I don't have to know these names. I'm just up here just in case anybody wants to look it up more. Holofernes.
And she finds a way to sneak into the Assyrian camp, the Greek camp, and she says to the guard, take me to Holofernes. And they say, we're not going to take you to Holofernes. Who are you? You're just some peasant woman. She says, no, I know. I've come from the Jewish camp, from Jerusalem, and I know what their weakness is. I can tell him what are the schedule of the guards. I can tell them how many troops they have and what have you. So they said, well, I guess not, no harm in that. So they bring her to him, and he says, you know, there's nothing going to happen with this woman here in terms of my safety being endangered. Take her away. Don't worry about anything. So she sits and talks with him, and she says, my lord, let me serve you. And she brings him wine, and she starts talking to him, and she brings him more wine. And she's telling him stuff, actually. And she brings him even more wine, and he passes out. He's so drunk. Well, she then takes his sword and chops off his head. She takes the head, wraps it up in her scarves, and walks out, and she says to the sentry, I'm going back to the Israelites now, so the Jews, so they don't think anything's wrong. So she brings back the head to the leader of the Jews, and she says, here's Holofernes' head. You now have the advantage. When they wake up in the morning, they're going to find that their leader is dead. You can attack. They'll be scared. And a great battle was won. Now, that's not really a story that I tell my kids, or that I told my kids, right? But that's a story that comes down in the sources. That, too, is part of what's going on here. Yep.
Don't you think that...
No, you know, that's a great question. Because, you know, when you look at I can't remember the terminology that they use for all the books of the New Testament. There's a certain word they use. When you,
yeah,
that didn't make it into the canon. Anyway, I'm not necessarily sure why the rabbis included that and didn't include. Actually, that's a pretty good guess when I come to think about it. When you look at the books of the Maccabees, really the